Chapter 41. Childie was nursing. And Charlie. Where is Charlie now? Out a washing, said the boy, beginning to walk up and down again, and taking the nankeen bonnet much too near the bedstead, by trying to gaze at us at the same time. We were looking at one another, and at these two children, when there came into the room a very little girl, childish in figure, but shrewd and older looking in the face, pretty face too, wearing a womanly sort of bonnet much too large for her, and drying her bare arms on a womanly sort of apron. Her fingers were white, and wrinkled with washing, and the soap suds were yet smoking which she wiped off her arms. But for this, she might have been a child playing at washing, and imitating a poor working woman with a quick observation of the truth. She had come running from some place in the neighborhood, and had made all the haste she could. Consequently, though she was very light, she was out of breath, and could not speak at first, as she stood panting, and wiping her arms, and looking quietly at us. "Oh, here's Charlie," said the boy. The child he was nursing stretched forth its arms, and cried out to be taken by Charlie. The little girl took it, in a womanly sort of manner belonging to the apron and the bonnet, and stood looking at us over the burden, that clung to her most affectionately. "Is it possible," whispered my guardian as we put a chair for the little creature, and got her to sit down with her load, the boy keeping close to her, holding to her apron, "that this child works for the rest? Look at this. For God's sake, look at this." It was a thing to look at. The three children close together, and two of them relying solely on the third, and the third so young, and yet with an air of age and steadiness, that sat so strangely on the childish figure. "Charlie, Charlie," said my guardian. "How old are you?"
"Over 13, sir," replied the child.
"Oh, what a great age," said my guardian. "What a great age, Charlie." I cannot describe the tenderness with which he spoke to her, half playfully yet all the more compassionately and mournfully. "And do you live alone here with these babies, Charlie?" said my guardian.
"Yes, sir," returned the child, looking up into his face with perfect confidence, "since father died."
"And how do you live, Charlie?"
"Oh, Charlie," said my guardian, turning his face away for a moment, "how do you live?"
"Since father died, sir, I've gone out to work. I'm out washing today."
"God help you, Charlie," said my guardian. "You're not tall enough to reach the tub."
"In pattens I am, sir," she said quickly. "I've got a high pair as belonged to mother."
"And when did mother die?"
"Poor mother."
"Mother died just after Emma was born," said the child, glancing at the face upon her bosom. "Then father said I was to be as good a mother to her as I could. And so I tried. And so I worked at home, and did cleaning, and nursing and washing for a long time, before I began to go out. And that's how I know how, don't you see, sir?"
"And do you often go out?"
"As often as I can," said Charlie, opening her eyes and smiling, "because of earning sixpences and shillings."
"And do you always lock the babies up when you go out?"
"To keep 'em safe, sir, don't you see?" said Charlie. "Mrs. Blinder comes up now and then, and Mr. Gridley comes up sometimes, and perhaps I can run in sometimes, and they can play, you know, and Tom and afraid of being locked up, are you, Tom?"
"No, oh," said Tom stoutly. "When it comes on dark, the lamps are lighted down in the court, and they show up here quite bright, almost quite bright. Don't they, Tom?"
"Yes, Charlie," said Tom, "almost quite bright."
"Then he's as good as gold," said the little creature, "oh, in such a motherly womanly way. And when Emma's tired, he puts her to bed. And when he's tired he goes to bed himself. And when I come home and light the candle, and has a bit of supper, he sits up again, and has it with me. Don't you, Tom?"
"Oh, yes, Charlie," said Tom, "that I do." And either in this glimpse of the great pleasure of his life or in gratitude and love for Charlie, who was all in all to him, he laid his face among the scanty folds of her frock, and passed from laughing into crying. It was the first time since our entry that a tear had been shed among these children. The little orphan girl had spoken of their father and their mother, as if all that sorrow were subdued by the necessity of taking courage, and by her childish importance in being able to work, and by her bustling busy way. But now, when Tom cried, although she sat quite tranquil, looking quietly at us, and did not by any movement disturb a hair of the head of either of her little charges, I saw two silent tears fall down her face. I stood at the window with Ada, pretending to look at the housetops, and the blackened stack of chimneys, and the poor plants, and the birds in little cages belonging to the neighbors, when I found that Mrs. Blinder, from the shop below, had come in. Perhaps it had taken her all this time to get upstairs, and was talking to my guardian. "It's not much to forgive 'em the rent, sir," she said. "Who could take it from them?" "Well, well," said my guardian to us too. "It is enough that the time will come when this good woman will find that it was much, and that for as much as she did it unto the least of these this child," he added after a few moments, "could she possibly continue this?" "Really, sir, I think she might," said Mrs. Blinder, getting her heavy breath by painful degrees. "She's as handy as it's possible to be. Bless you, sir, the way she tended them two children after the mother died was the talk of the yard. And it was a wonder to see her with him after he was took ill, it really was." "Apostrophe Mrs. Blinder, apostrophe," he said to me the very last he spoke he was lying there, "apostrophe Mrs. Blinder, whatever my calling may have been, I see a angel sitting in this room last night along with my child, and I trust her to our Father." "Apostrophe, he had no other calling?" said my guardian. "No, sir," returned Mrs. Blinder, "he was nothing but a follower's. When he first came to lodge here, I didn't know what he was, and I confess that, when I found out I gave him notice. It wasn't liked in the yard. It wasn't approved by the other lodgers. It is not a genteel calling," said Mrs. Blinder, "and most people do object to it. Mr. Gridley objected to it very strong, and he is a good lodger, though his temper has been hard tried." "So you gave him notice?" said my guardian. "So I gave him notice," said Mrs. Blinder. "But really when the time came, and I knew no other ill of him, I was in doubts. He was punctual and diligent. He did what he had to do, sir," said Mrs. Blinder, unconsciously fixing Mr. Skimpole with her eye, "and it's something in this world even to do that." "So you kept him after all?" "Why, I said that, if he could arrange with Mr. Gridley, I could arrange it with the other lodgers, and should not so much mind its being liked or disliked in the yard. Mr. Gridley gave his consent gruff but gave it. He was always gruff with him, but he has been kind to the children since. A person is never known till a person is proved." "Have many people been kind to the children?" asked Mr. Jarndyce. "Upon the whole, not so bad, sir," said Mrs. Blinder, "but certainly not so many as would have been if their father's calling had been different. Mr. Covens gave a guinea, and the Fowlers made up a little purse. Some neighbors in the yard, that had always joked, and tapped their shoulders, when he went by came forward with a little subscription, and in general not so bad. Similarly with Charlotte. Some people won't employ her, because she was a Fowler's child. Some people that do employ her cast it at her. Some make a merit of having her to work for them, with that and all her drawbacks upon her, and perhaps pay her less and put upon her more. But she's patienter than others would be, and is clever too, and always willing, up to the full mark of her strength and over. So I should say, in general, not so bad, sir, but might be better." Mrs. Blinder sat down to give herself a more favorable opportunity of recovering her breath, exhausted anew by so much talking before it was fully restored. Mr. Jarndyce was turning to speak to us, when his attention was attracted by the abrupt entrance into the room of the Mr. Gridley who had been mentioned, and whom we had seen on our way up. "I don't know what you may be doing here, ladies and gentlemen," he said, as if he resented our presence, "but you'll excuse my coming in. I don't come in to stare about me.
Well, Charlie.
Well, Tom.
Well, little one. How is it with us all today?
He bent over the group in a caressing way, and clearly was regarded as a friend by the children, though his face retained its stern character, and his manner to us was as rude as it could be. My guardian noticed it and respected it.
No one, surely, would come here to stare about him, he said mildly.
Maybe so, sir, maybe so, returned the other, taking Tom upon his knee and waving him off impatiently.
I don't want to argue with ladies and gentlemen. I have had enough of arguing, to last one man his life.
You have sufficient reason, I dare say, said Mr. Jarndyce, for being chafed and irritated.
There again, exclaimed the man, becoming violently angry.
I am of a quarrelsome temper. I am irascible. I am not polite.
Not very, I think.
Sir, said Gridley, putting down the child and going up to him, as if he meant to strike him, do you know anything of courts of equity?
Perhaps I do, to my sorrow.
To your sorrow? Said the man, pausing in his wrath.
If so, I beg your pardon.
I am not polite, I know.
I beg your pardon.
Sir, with renewed violence, I have been dragged for 25 years over burning iron, and I have lost the habit of treading upon velvet.
Go into the court of chancery yonder, and ask what is one of the standing jokes that brighten up their business sometimes, and they will tell you that the best joke they have is the man from Shropshire.
I, he said, beating one hand on the other passionately, am the man from Shropshire.
I believe I and my family have also had the honor of furnishing some entertainment in the same grave place, said my guardian composedly.
You may have heard my name Jarndyce.
Mr. Jarndyce, said Gridley with a rough sort of salutation, you bear your wrongs more quietly than I can bear mine.
More than that, I tell you and I tell this gentleman, and these young ladies, if they are friends of yours, that, if I took my wrongs in any other way, I should be driven mad.
It is only by resenting them, and by revenging them in my mind, and by angrily demanding the justice I never get, that I am able to keep my wits together.
It is only that, he said, speaking in a homely rustic way, and with great vehemence.
You may tell me that I overexcite myself.
I answer that it's in my nature to do it, under wrong, and I must do it.
There's nothing between doing it and sinking into the smiling state of the poor little mad woman that haunts the court. If I was once to sit down under it, I should become imbecile.
The passion and heat in which he was, and the manner in which his face worked, and the violent gestures with which he accompanied what he said, were most painful to see.
Mr. Jarndyce, he said, consider my case.
As true as there is a heaven above us, this is my case. I am one of two brothers. My father, a farmer, made a will, and left his farm and stock, and so forth to my mother for her life. After my mother's death, all was to come to me except a legacy of £300, that I was then to pay my brother. My mother died. My brother some time afterwards claimed his legacy. I and some of my relations said that he had had a part of it already in board and lodging, and some other things.
Now mind, that was the question, and nothing else.
No one disputed the will. No one disputed anything but whether part of that £300 had been already paid or not.
To settle that question, my brother filing a bill, I was obliged to go into this accursed chancery.
I was forced there because the law forced me and would let me go nowhere else.
17 people were made defendants to that simple suit.
It first came on after 2 years.
It was then stopped for another 2 years, while the master may his head rot off.
Inquired whether I was my father's son, about which there was no dispute at all with any mortal creature.
He then found out that there were not defendants enough. Remember, there were only 17 as yet, but that we must have another who had been left out, and must begin all over again.
The costs at that time before the thing was begun were 3 times the legacy.
My brother would have given up the legacy, and joyful, to escape more costs.
My whole estate, left to me in that will of my father's, has gone in costs. The suit, still undecided, has fallen into rack, and ruin, and despair, with everything else, and here I stand, this day. Now, Mr. Jarndyce, in your suit there are thousands and thousands involved, where in mine there are hundreds. Is mine less hard to bear, or is it harder to bear, when my whole living was in it, and has been thus shamefully sucked away? Mr. Jarndyce said, that he condoled with him with all his heart, and that he set up no monopoly himself in being unjustly treated by this monstrous system. There again, said Mr. Gridley with no diminution of his rage. The system. I am told on all hands, it's the system. I mustn't look to individuals. It's the system. I mustn't go into court and say, my lord, I beg to know this from you, is this right or wrong? Have you the face to tell me I have received justice, and therefore am dismissed? ... My lord knows nothing of it. He sits there to administer the system. I mustn't go to Mr. Tulkinghorn, the solicitor in Lincoln's Inn Fields, and say to him, when he makes me furious by being so cool and satisfied as they all do, for I know they gain by it while I lose, don't I? I mustn't say to him, I... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.